in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Good day to all of you, our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have For a Better Life. This program teaches us practical ethics and morals which we can use in our lives from the point of view of Islam. Around the World with Reporters will be our final program this hour. Reporters from around the world tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from countries both near and afar. Stay with us for the next hour.
When this documentary was made, a year had passed since the start of the Zionist regime's aggression against Gaza. During this period, Israelis have killed more than 50,000 Palestinians, including the missing and those trapped under rubble, 60% of whom are women and children. This massive loss has driven people to the streets in protest.
From the river to the sea!
50,000 deaths in a year is not a small number. It suggests the Israeli army is primarily fighting the people of Gaza rather than the resistance fighters. The scale of this number makes it hard to believe claims that civilians are merely human shields or collateral damage in the conflict. This has prompted reactions not only from people worldwide, especially in Europe and the U.S., but also from the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
Israel has a genocidal intent against the Palestinians in Gaza.
Despite all these protests, Israeli politicians are not sorry at all, and every day they add dozens of Palestinians to the number of Palestinians they kill. Gaza is bombarded, schools and hospitals are destroyed, and people and children get trapped. In short, the Zionist entity is killing people in a way that it seems more like venting a grudge against a nation rather than an actual war.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Arafat, His Excellency Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister of Israel, the President of the United States.
Yasser Arafat, Yitzhak Rabin, and Bill Clinton together in one frame. This was perhaps the most remarkable image that could be broadcast to the world in 1993. On September 13, 1993, Yasser Arafat, one of the oldest leaders of the Palestinian struggle, laid down his arms and signed a peace agreement known as the Oslo Accords in Washington. In the Oslo Accords, Arafat recognized the State of Israel and condemned the use of violence against it. In return, Israel recognized Arafat and his group as the legitimate representatives of the Palestinian people and agreed to the formation of a Palestinian Authority as a temporary administrative body. The West was pleased with the development that the Nobel Peace Prize was simultaneously awarded to the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, and leader of the Palestinian Fatah movement, Yasser Arafat. At that time, the commemorative photo was interpreted as the end of an era of enmity between Palestinians and Israelis. However, this is not the first time the West, especially the United States, had brought Arabs to the negotiating table with Israel.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, the President of the Arab Republic of Egypt, and the Prime Minister of Israel.
In 1978, U.S. President Carter had managed to convince Anwar Sadat, president of the most powerful Arab country opposing Israel, to make peace with the regime.
I hope that the foresight and the wisdom that have made this session a success will guide these leaders and the leaders of all nations as they continue the progress toward peace. Thank you very much.
After the Camp David Accords, the West made significant efforts through both open and secret negotiations, such as those in Madrid and Egypt's Sharm el-Sheikh, to persuade other Arab countries to cease hostilities with Israel. These efforts were sometimes successful. The reconciliation of Arab countries left Palestinians feeling abandoned in their fight against the occupation. Gradually, figures like Yasser Arafat concluded that armed struggle was futile and that it was time to negotiate. This is what happened with the Oslo Accords.
A moment when we dared to pledge what for so long seemed difficult even to imagine, that the security of the Israeli people will be reconciled with the hopes of the Palestinian people, and there will be more security and more hope for all.
The primary reason for America's satisfaction with the Oslo Accords was the security of Israel and the end of Palestinian resistance. Westerners believe that since Palestinian leaders had recognized Israel, there's no reason for others to act more concerned than the people directly involved and continue fighting against Israeli occupation. So they try to present Yasser Arafat as a sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, sidelining other Palestinian groups that still saw resistance as a path to liberation. The narrative was reflected in the media coverage of Arafat's return to Palestine, portraying him as a lone savior of his people. On June 12, 1994, Yasser Arafat returns to Gaza to establish the Palestinian Authority with East Al-Quds as its capital as per the Oslo Accords. This government was expected to gain full control over Gaza and the West Bank within 4 to 5 years.
We will establish our independent state on any part of Palestine from which the Israelis will withdraw or liberate it. It is obvious and clear.
With Arafat leading the Palestinian Authority, the next step was to form the Palestinian Legislative Council. In the absence of opposition to reconciliation with Israel, the first elections were held in 1996, resulting in a victory for Arafat's allies. Consequently, all aspects of the Palestinian Authority were now in the hands of those favoring peace with Israel. In the Oslo Accords, Arafat secured a promise that no more Palestinian land in Gaza and the West Bank would be seized and that settlement construction for Israelis in these areas would cease. Another agreement with Yitzhak Rabin was that Palestinians in the diaspora worldwide, estimated at over 3 million people at the time, could return to areas under the Palestinian Authority's control. Arafat obtained these concessions at a high cost of recognizing the occupation of a large part of Palestine, a reality that Palestinian resistance groups protested. Based on these promises and agreements, Arafat's achievements were presented as complete victory in the world media. But that was not the entire story. Despite all the hype, not all Zionists supported the Oslo Accords. Many Zionist political factions did not even consider Palestinians as human beings, let alone agree to negotiate and establish a government with them. They viewed all of Palestine, especially Al-Quds, as their own.
We want the Palestinians that said, this is our land, this is our country, this is our city.
Over the years, Israelis have forced many Palestinians into migration and displacement through harassment, killing, and threats. It was clear they would not agree to the return of Palestinians in the diaspora to areas under the control of the Palestinian Authority under the Oslo Accords. The peak of Israeli opposition to the Oslo Accords took place on November 4, 1995, when Yitzhak Rabin, who had negotiated with Arafat, was assassinated. Yitzhak Rabin was a staunch Zionist who served twice as prime minister. Besides his political roles, he was considered a seasoned general who had achieved victories for Israel through the killing of Palestinians and other Arabs in various wars. He was one of the two commanders of the Israeli army during the Six-Day War in 1967 and demonstrated such competence that he became a major general at 32 years old and a lieutenant general at just 40, the highest rank in the Israeli army. Due to his extensive experience, Rabin learned that victory could not be achieved solely through suppression and war. Sometimes it was necessary to engage Palestinians in political maneuvers to make Israel a safer place for Zionists. He realized the need for peace with Palestinians during the First Intifada, a widespread Palestinian uprising that began in 1987 and could not be quelled by Zionists no matter what they did. Although the Oslo Accords ended the First Intifada, many Zionists viewed negotiations with Palestinians as legitimizing them. This led to Rabin's assassination to deter anyone from negotiating with the Palestinians or granting them concessions, even superficially. Thus, the Zionists themselves had eliminated one of the three key figures in the Oslo Accords. With Rabin's death, the anti-negotiation faction led by the Likud Party and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came to power. Netanyahu has been a dominant figure among the Zionists, holding the Prime Minister's office for 16 of the past 28 years. Palestinians were now concerned about the Oslo Accords, as the new government had no intention of returning the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to their rightful owners. Instead, land confiscation and settlement construction by Zionists had doubled compared to when Arafat was still armed and advocating for Palestinian freedom. The rise of the Likud Party worsened the living conditions of Palestinians, pushing unemployment among them to 70%. According to the Oslo Accords, Yasser Arafat had agreed to divide the West Bank into three areas. Area A, covering 18% under full Palestinian Authority control. Area B, covering 21% under Palestinian administrative control, but Israeli security controlled. And Area C, covering 61% under full Israeli control. The first problem of this division was that it became difficult for Palestinians to move in these areas, let alone get involved in trade, production, and agriculture.
Palestinians have to drive or ride on the older roads. When they want to travel from one town to another, they have to submit to humiliating delays at checkpoints and roadblocks,
I think the main goal is to fragment the West Bank. I think the vast majority of them are basically to block the movement of people from one place to another.
The next important point was Arafat had accepted the division on the condition that within 4 to 5 years, the Palestinian Authority would gain full control over the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. However, as time passed, there were no signs that the Zionists would honor their commitments. The situation became more unbearable for Palestinians as news of financial and administrative corruption among Arafat's supporters and the disappearance of international aid funds surfaced.
But while many struggle to raise the $20 a year now necessary to send a child to a UN school, millions of dollars of international aid have been wasted, misused, and misappropriated.
And also, you know, when the people look at some in the government, that those people used to struggle for the sake of Palestine, and today they are misusing their position, or they work, or they do something which is against the interest of their own people. You know, this makes some the people feel disappointed, to feel that this is not what we want, this is not what we struggle for.
It led to public dissatisfaction with the negotiating team. If the situation were to proceed in the same way, the legitimacy of Arafat and his friends would be lost among the Palestinian people, and the position of his rivals would be strengthened. That was the time when Bill Clinton, in the last days of his presidency, got into play and gathered Yasser Arafat and the Prime Minister of Israel together so the good memories of the Oslo Agreement might be repeated. At that time, Ehud Barak was a Prime Minister of the Israeli regime.
Let me say, I am delighted to see Chairman Arafat again. The United States is prepared to do all we can to assist them in coming to an agreement. Well, I'm certainly willing to do anything I can to achieve a peaceful settlement in the Middle East.
However, things did not go forward as the U.S. wanted. Barak refused to even honor past agreements, and Arafat, having faced 7 years of broken promises, saw his honor in front of the Palestinians at stake. This is how he insisted on the implementation of the previous agreements, and unlike in 1993, it caused negotiations to fail. The peace process had failed, and the occupied territories were like a powder keg waiting for a spark. This time, the spark was ignited by another notorious Zionist, Ariel Sharon, a ruthless Israeli military figure known as the Butcher for the many Palestinians he had killed. Sharon's visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque was seen as a final blow to the Oslo peace process. Palestinians protested the desecration, leading to widespread demonstrations that later on came to be known as the Second Intifada or the Al-Aqsa Intifada. The protests were met with severe repression by the Israeli military and police. Yasser Arafat could no longer remain silent in the face of such violence against Palestinians and the Israelis' unfulfilled promises. He formally protested, and after seeing the U.S. and the West were not listening, shifted his stance after 7 years and in a U-turn supported the resistance like most Palestinians.
You have to remember why they had moved. The visit of Sharon to our very important and religious place for the whole Muslims.
Arafat's change in tone was enough for the Israelis to attack his headquarters, placing him under house arrest.
Well, Well, this was a very strong message conveyed to Arafat and his people, that we are able to be there and to surround the place whenever we want, according, of course, to operational needs. I believe that Arafat understands this message.
Yasser Arafat remained under house arrest for the rest of his life. Despite his pleas to end the situation, even the United States ignored his requests. During this time, he developed cancer but was denied permission to leave for treatment. Eventually, his weakened body was transferred to a military hospital in France, where shortly after, he passed away on November the 11th, 2004. Later, laboratory investigations in Switzerland revealed that Arafat's personal belongings and clothes were contaminated with radioactive substances, and this meant that Arafat had died as a result of a biological attack. Now, the second person present in the picture had been eliminated.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history. Should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. The wise man sees the value in every heart, whether it beats in silence or in the song. Peace and blessings, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of For a Better Life. This is Nahid, having the honor of hosting you on this episode, where we explore values that enrich our lives and strengthen our communities. Today, we will reflect on a subtle but profound virtue, respecting people with different characteristics, whether they are introverted or extroverted, quiet or outspoken, contemplative or energetic. Respect is not only a social requirement, it's the reflection of a spiritual awareness, recognizing that Allah has created each soul with unique strength and needs. But before we start, let me set a situation into your minds. I remember school and those kids who were always sitting in the last row of the chairs, and those kids who were less talkative and were so quiet, didn't want to enter any discussion or challenges at school. Did we consider them as valuable, as worthy of those people around who were so talkative, active, and energetic? Unfortunately, some of us might have the answer of no. I mean, the most talkative person was always valued, while the less talkative and quiet girl or boy who was sitting in a class was not considered with the same scale, on the same scale of being valuable. That's why today we're going to consider this issue on the Islamic point of view, and at the same time, the literary, wonderful eyes of Sa'di Shirazi. Well, Sa'di in Bustan narrates a story of two travelers, one calm and thoughtful, the other lively and expressive. Both were judged by others as better or worse until a wise elder pointed out, "Every soul has its season, and every temperament its treasure. To honor one is to honor the divine." This story reminds us that differences are not defects. They are divine designs meant to complement the richness of life. The Holy Book of Quran emphasizes the dignity and uniqueness of every human being in this way. "We created you and diverse tribes and nations so that you may know one another." Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam had said, "Whoever guides another to goodness has a reward equal to the one who follows it." Imam Ali alayhi salam instructed, "Do not belittle anyone, for every soul has its own worth in the eye of Allah." So recognizing and honoring differences is therefore both a spiritual and social duty. Now, introverts often reflect deeply, value quiet spaces, and recharge through solitude. Extroverts may draw energy from interaction, thrive in social settings, and express themselves freely. Respecting introverts means giving them space, listening without pressure, and valuing thoughtful contribution. Respecting the extroverts, on the other hand, can mean appreciating their energy, including them in shared activities, and acknowledging their expressive ideas. Islam encourages consideration for every temperament, an echo of the Prophet's teachings to treat all with gentleness. Now, what are some ways and how can I improve my way of connection towards different groups of people? We're going to go for a short break, then come back to talk about those practical ways which can help us all.
ارتباطتون رو با خدا قوی کنید. در مسائل دینی به نقاط عقلانی و ظریف.
Improve your connection with God. Pay attention to logical and detailed points in religious issues and learn them from great masters. There are sentiments in religion, but they rely on deep ideality and deep thought. This thought must be learned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Welcome back to For a Better Life, where we are talking about different groups of people, be it introverted or extroverted, and how can we value them with the same scale? How can we have no discriminations between the different characteristics of people? Well, the first practical way can be to listen actively, tailoring our approach to each personality, or avoiding labels. Many people just simply label others as shy, outgoing, quiet, extroverted, but we shouldn't dismiss the quietness as weakness or talkativeness as friendliness. So this is very important that we need to stop ourselves as teachers, as co-workers, as colleagues, as friends or classmates who are seeing other people with other characteristics as well. The other way can be encouraging without pressure, respecting their pace of engagement and celebrating their strength, recognizing what each brings to the team, family, or community. And of course, practicing patience. Differences require understanding and humility. Through these actions, we cultivate a society of acceptance, a society of empathy and cooperation. Now, Saadi recounts a scholar who noticed that a silent student often observed more than those who spoke constantly. Recognizing his insight, the teacher honored his perspective. Similarly, Imam Ali alayhi salam treated each companion according to their strength, nurturing diversity while maintaining justice and equality. These examples all show us that respect is adaptive, mindful, and compassionate. Now, respecting the differences is not abstract. It appears in everyday life, like allowing our colleagues their preferred working style, like listening to our family members without rushing them, like acknowledging our friends' way of celebrating or grieving, or even simpler, avoiding the imposing of our style on other people. By respecting differences, we honor Allah's wisdom in creation and strengthen deep human being bonds. As we know, whatever responsibility, whatever job position that we have, as Muslims, we have this responsibility of staying connected, staying brothers and sisters with each other. So my brothers and sisters, please remember in whatever position that you are responsible for the others' feeling, for the others' vibes while they are at the workplace, that you are also there. We can create a better place for them by just simply looking at them and considering them, by trying to be in their shoes, to feel the way they are feeling. If I'm an introverted working with you as my teacher, and you are not recognizing the kind of silence that I need to go deeper into my thoughts and find even more creative ways than my classmates, then this is a problem here. You as a teacher are going to invest some time on understanding me and trying me to improve as part of the Islamic society. As we conclude, remember, every personality is a unique thread in the tapestry of society. Introverted or extroverted, reflective or expressive, each has a role and a purpose. Saadi wrote, "Do not despise the quiet soul, for silence often speaks wisdom beyond words." Similarly, in the same way, extroverted voices, when guided by virtue, illuminate the hearts and unite the communities. So, dear listeners, let your respect extend to every soul you encounter. Greet introverts with patience, embrace extroverts with warmth, and honor all with sincere appreciation. As we part, I leave you this thought. May your heart hold patience, your ears hear with care, your words uplift every spirit, and your understanding of characters echo like a gentle wind of peace. With that, I say, I wish you great connections with every person that you are working with, you are seeing, or you are meeting with. I wish you understanding of different characteristics, and I wish you will be well understood by those who see you with whatever feature that you have. And with the wishes of the best Islamic characteristics to be built in our personalities. Until our next episode, I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Stories published by some Italian newspapers early this week about several groups of Israeli soldiers taking holidays in popular Italian seaside destinations have sparked political outcry in the country. Hundreds of soldiers belonging to the Israeli forces have been seen spending their holiday in luxury premises and hotels in the Marche region and on the island of Sardinia, resting and relaxing after having participated in Israel's genocidal operations in Gaza. The off-duty soldiers were allegedly escorted by Italian police during their period of rest.
What's happened over the past weeks with Israeli soldiers on a period of rest or decompression at our resorts after having committed war crimes is unacceptable. As Spain imposes entry ban on Israel's ministers, Italy not only provides luxury accommodation to the Israeli soldiers, but it even provides police escort services. It's the evidence of the Italian government's complicity with Israel.
Some Israeli soldiers who have refused to join the genocidal operations in Gaza have been jailed for their decision. This drift is taking us nowhere good. History will be the judge.
In Sardinia, pro-Palestinian groups have voiced their opposition to the presence of the Israeli soldiers, with some activists declaring, "We don't want war criminals on our island."
Meanwhile, a group of professionals from the Lazio Region Journalist Association gathered in central Rome, not far from Italy's government building, to hold a commemorative event for all Palestinian journalists who have so far been murdered by Israel in Gaza. The names of all the 250 slain journalists and media workers are being read out by the Italian colleagues.
Read out the names of the slain journalists in Gaza reminds us that a propaganda war is also in place, with Israel doing what it wants with the complicity of several Western states. Israel's deliberate strategy of murdering journalists is aimed at controlling the information coming out from Gaza.
The initiative was held as a national pro-Palestine demonstration is set to take place in the Italian capital, Rome, in early October. Max Civili, Rome.
The resolution introduced by the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation entitled "The Commemoration of the 1500th Anniversary of the Birth of Prophet Muhammad" highlights the Prophet Muhammad as a prophet of mercy whose life embodied compassion, justice, and human dignity.
This declaration is not merely a marker of time. It is a call to reflection, to unity, and to renewed commitment to the noble values. This is not the time for division. It's the time for unity. The challenges we face demand nothing less than unwavering solidarity and support.
Ambassadors from many Muslim countries like Lebanon, Oman, Pakistan and Afghanistan, as well as former ministers from Austria, attended the event. Apart from diplomats and politicians, religious and academic figures also took part in ceremony, which featured an exhibition of the Holy Quran, traditional music and prayers.
The Prophet is an example is a mercy for all of mankind, not only for the believers, but believers and non-believers, Christians, faithful.
Iranian Ambassador Eshraq Chahomi stressed the enormous importance of the Year of Mercy as the world witnesses the genocide in Gaza.
Most pressing issue at the time is the issue of Palestine and the genocide which is going on in Gaza Strip, which is deplorable. And indeed, the Islamic Ummah should come together with a unified position, condemn such atrocities by the Israelis against the Palestinian people.
800,000 Muslims live in Austria. This is 8% of the entire population, which makes them the largest minority in the country. The birth anniversary is an opportunity to translate the values and the memory of Prophet Muhammad into practical dialogue across cultures and society. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
In Palestine, the school year began this week with more anxiety than celebration. Instead of focusing on books and lessons, families worry whether their children will return home safely. Military raids, arrests, and checkpoints stand between students and their classrooms. For many, even the schools themselves are in danger. In Assawiya village, a school sits under a cloud of uncertainty after Israeli lawmaker Zvi Scott from the Religious Zionism Party incited for its demolition, portraying children's education as a threat to settlers.
Recently, we were shocked to see a Knesset member inciting against our school, which stands as proof of the Palestinian people's right to this land. This secondary school was founded in 1944 and serves three nearby villages. Like so many Palestinian schools, it is under constant threat from the Israeli occupation, motivated by land seizure and an effort to obstruct education.
Teachers and students say they face daily harassment, from military checkpoints and raids to the fear of demolition. For students, the start of a new school year is meant to be filled with hope and learning. But here under occupation, the daily presence of the army turns education into a struggle for survival. Fear, checkpoints, and military raids seep into classrooms, disrupting the very right to learn.
The situation here is very difficult. We never know if we'll make it to class or be turned back. The army's presence creates fear and tension, making it hard to focus during lessons or exams. Many times, soldiers come into the school, and for weeks, they've tried to take over our building.
When we're at school, there's no sense of safety. Even during breaks, we're denied the chance to go outside. In sports class, if the ball goes beyond the gate, we can't get it back. We live in fear because soldiers surround us with weapons while we have nothing. But this school was here before them, older than their entire history, and that's why they want to erase it.
Education has long been a form of resistance, a way to preserve identity and hope despite occupation. But as Israel intensifies restrictions and incitements against schools, parents and children alike fear that the right to learn is being systematically stripped away. Here inside the school, the desks and chalkboards tell a simple story. Children just want to learn. Yet for Palestinian students, even classrooms are treated as battlegrounds. As this school year begins, their resilience is tested once again amid Israeli violence. Naqa Ahmed, Occupied West Bank.
Sudan is reeling from a humanitarian crisis caused by military clashes inside the country. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus delivered his remarks on the situation in Sudan this Saturday. He warned that famine is already confirmed in parts of the country, with over 770,000 children expected to suffer from acute malnutrition this year, alongside a nationwide cholera outbreak.
more than 260,000 people need urgent health assistance. 35 health facilities have been destroyed. There are 5,000 suspected cholera cases and 98 deaths. 130,000 children are suffering from malnutrition.
The crisis is most severe in North Darfur, where the paramilitary rapid support forces have maintained a siege since May 2024. Local doctors report that over the past week, RSF artillery strikes killed at least 18 civilians and wounded more than 100 others. Despite international pledges, the RSF continues to block humanitarian aid, leaving the population increasingly vulnerable.
As an organization, we have delivered medical aid to more than 11 health centers in Darfur, including Kelma Camp, the largest displacement camp, now facing a severe cholera outbreak with around 700 cases and 40 deaths. Across Darfur, infections exceeded 10,500.
The UN recently described Sudan as facing the world's largest hunger crisis, with aid deliveries severely constrained by insecurity and RSF blockades. In Al-Fashir and North Darfur, families remain trapped, struggling for food, clean water, and medical care. Local organizations are stepping in with what little they have, distributing food and basic necessities to curb the spread of cholera. Families in Al-Fashir endure RSF siege, where cholera spreads and children are facing severe malnutrition. Survival depends on aid breaking through the blockade, because this war is now fought not just with weapons, but with hunger. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Mohammed has once again topped the list of names for newborn boys in the UK. The Muslim community here say they are thrilled.
Honestly, as a Muslim, yeah, I'm so proud. Mohammed's name is the number one, not just in the UK, in the whole world.
Data from the Office for National Statistics confirms that for the second year running, the Prophet of Islam's name with this spelling was the most popular choice for boys. That's over 5,700 newborn boys in England and Wales in 2024, firmly overtaking the previous favorites, Noah and Oliver.
Since the events of October 7th, 2023, British Muslims have faced an unprecedented rise in the number of attacks and incidents of abuse. Having a Muslim-sounding name can expose individuals to discrimination, and yet none of that appears to have had any impact on the appeal of the Prophet's name among the parents here.
This is not new. Muhammad has been in the top 10 names for baby boys in Britain since 2016. And parents naming their boys after him goes back a long time.
The character of the Prophet, peace be upon him, as a mercy to the whole creation and as a role model to sort of address the needs and aspiration of us as Muslims and everybody else, indeed is the reason that people name their children, because they name their children because they want to promote that character.
A character that's needed today more than ever.
Because of the genocide, because of the selfishness that the world is going, because of the way that we are ignoring even our environment and everything else.
And while some say the trend is not always faith-driven, that pop culture and famous sports personalities of the same name may also play their part, others say in the end it all boils down to Prophet Muhammad himself.
We think about the Prophet first. This is the main reason people putting their names afterward. And after that, it's the celebrities or any other names you can consider it off. But for me as a believer, I would say that it's just my love with my Prophet.
Other Islamic boy names, Yusuf and Yahya, among them, have also risen in the rankings compared with last year, reinforcing the belief that Islam is not only the UK's, but the world's fastest growing religion. Saeed Pariza, London.
Over 2,000 Muslim scholars from across the Islamic world in Tehran, on the occasion of the 1500th birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, all here to participate in the 39th International Islamic Unity Conference, an annual international event marking the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, that aims to foster unity and solidarity among Muslims worldwide.
It is a great occasion. So many people from across the world are here assembled, and this seminar is held at a very crucial time.
Not surprisingly, in any such gathering, the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza taking center stage.
There is an aggression against Gaza. So this is a time to be united, Muslim Ummah.
Participants consider this year's conference a platform to condemn the recent Israeli-American acts of aggression in the region.
I want to express my condemnation of all kinds of attacks carried out by Israel and the United States against Iran. If the Islamic world and Muslims were truly united, they would never have dared to do such a thing.
This is a very important conference, and for the unity and the silatul rahim of Muslims of the Ummah all over the world. And I hope what transpires from this is action among the Muslim world to save the Ummah. Starting with the one in Gaza.
Participants are also calling for prioritizing trade among Muslim countries and a complete boycott of Western goods that are fueling the Israeli regime's genocide in Gaza.
All of Muslims should start to have their own domestic product and buy each other products within Muslim countries and stop buying products from the West.
Today, the Muslim world is facing numerous challenges, and the participants share the belief that ties among the Muslim Ummah and unity among Muslim nations is the only solution.
With the presence of Muslim scholars and intellectuals from around the world, the 39th International Islamic Unity Conference has begun in Tehran, running from September 8th to 10th. Ali Reza Akbari, Tehran.
Ya Rabbi, ya Qahhar, ya
cast into the light. Oh Allah, your blessings are so many, they're too many to count. Oh my Lord, as much as I praise you, I can't thank you enough. Oh Allah, your blessings are so many, they're too many to count. Oh my Lord, as much as I praise you, I can't thank you.
Good day to all of you, our listeners. This is Iran Radio. It's nice to have you with us, and I'm your host for the next hour. Here are some interesting facts about Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning, the recitation, the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we'll listen to the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter. The beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by Islamic upbringing. The program aims to answer frequently asked questions regarding children and adolescents and their upbringing. Our radio productions feature will be our final program this hour. Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's genocidal campaign continues in Gaza with a focus on Gaza City, where the regime's military operations cause more death and destruction. Lebanon's health ministry confirms the killing of one person in an Israeli drone strike near the city of Tyre. And also in our headlines, Israeli media say a suspected Yemeni missile has targeted the occupied territories a day after the regime's attacks on Sana'a and Jaf left 35 people dead. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Israel's genocidal campaign continues in Gaza with a focus on Gaza City, where the regime's military operations cause more death and destruction. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, 16 Palestinians have been killed since the early hours of Thursday. In one of the latest attacks, 4 people were killed and over 47 others were injured when Israeli forces opened fire on aid seekers at the Netzarim corridor in central Gaza. In central Gaza, Israeli attack on a residential home in Al Buraij refugee camp claimed the life of a child. The regime's genocide in Gaza since October 2023 has so far killed nearly 64,600